This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zacharin, assistant editor of the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Dr. William B. Allen, professor emeritus at Michigan State University. We are discussing his recently published translation and commentary on Montesquieu's The Spirit of the Laws. Published originally in 1748, The Spirit of the Laws is one of the most important political treatises of the Enlightenment. Montesquieu's writing has had a profound influence, especially on the United States Constitution. William, thank you for joining me today on the New Books Network to discuss this historically significant work. Of course, yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah, this is I don't want to undersell it. This is a very hefty volume. So you've clearly spent a lot of time mulling over the sentences here. You know, in addition to translating it, you also provide a pretty lengthy commentary. But before talking about Montesquieu and Spirit of Laws, I was wondering if you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure, I'd be happy to. And I want to, first of all, thank you for giving me the opportunity to spend the time with you. You're quite right. It's a hefty volume. In fact, I typically refer to it as a doorstop. So, but I like to remind people, Caleb, that it's 1,000 pages, but it's parallel text, French and English. So you only have to read half. And you can choose the half you want. So I think that it is accessible, and it is especially accessible for the French text, which isn't always so readily available to people, as well as a new translation. But as for who I am, I'm someone who came to this study a long time ago, as I was at the earliest stages of my professional development, with my focus on the founding of the United States, and the course of which I discovered a confrontation between the Federalists and Anti-Federalists who were debating the Constitution while it was pending ratification. And interestingly enough, each cited as authority Montesquieu. Each claimed Montesquieu as defending its position on the case of the Anti-Federalists that you needed to have a small republic to be democratic. And in the case of the Federalists, that no, Montesquieu actually pointed out that it would take an extended republic or a large republic in order to be safely democratic, only requiring the introduction of the principle of representation. So that it struck me then, as I was preparing my doctoral thesis, somebody needed to resolve the question of who was right. These were mutually exclusive propositions. They couldn't both be right. And it is that in that spirit that I undertook the study of Montesquieu. And in the course of undertaking that study, I was also a Fulbright scholar in France and took the occasion, therefore, to read the manuscripts of Montesquieu at the Bibliothèque Nationale and to begin the process of translation as part of reading, not so much intending at that point to publish, but just to be clear in my mind about Montesquieu's argument. And I discovered the most exciting and extraordinary thing, that while it was correct that both statements were present in Montesquieu, they were present with nuance that led to an understanding that the defense of the small democracy was precisely constrained by its smallness, which Montesquieu in the end tells us by Book 8 of The Spirit of the Laws can't survive because it can't defend itself. And then he makes a transition to provide a case for an extended republic. So that it was clear that it took a more subtle understanding in the context of the founding to appreciate both what was happening in the United States as defended in Federalist Paper No. 10, for example, Federalist Paper No. 9, and what Montesquieu was arguing. But in the process of doing that, and this is what you want to get to and what you're interested in, what I learned was that this was not the heart of Montesquieu. This is important. This unlocks the door to his constitutionalism. But his was actually the project of modern liberal reform across the board. And the political philosopher Thomas Pengel introduced this very early on in a book he published called The Spirit of Modern Liberalism, which was all an account of Montesquieu. And it meant that the most important thing about Montesquieu did not lie in the separation of powers and checks and balances, as important as those were, but in what this characterization of the modern regime should look like. And that's when the idea that I needed to pursue this work through to the end and provide an adequate translation in English, far better than those that existed to this point, was so critical, because we had missed the point in many of our studies about the Enlightenment thought. We had privileged Rousseau, Locke, Hobbes. We had depreciated Montesquieu. And it turns out that Montesquieu was a more central figure in many respects than any of those others.
Yeah, it's certainly, you know, the case. This is certainly something that when we, you know, I'd love to talk about the relevance of Montesquieu today towards the end of the conversation. But it's, you know, certainly it's the case that Montesquieu gets kind of skipped over. He gets mentioned in kind of standard political theory surveys, but he really is kind of shoved to the back in favor of Hobbes, Locke, and Rousseau as the kind of main political theorists that tend to get looked at least by, you know, undergraduate students. But before, you know, jumping into the different interpretations and influences of him, you know, could you give just a very basic overview of who Montesquieu the man was? You know, why is he someone whose word we should take on how to form a proper government?
Well, it's interesting because, of course, Montesquieu was a nobleman born at the end of the 17th century, and at a point at which the reigning political power was, of course, the Sun King, Louis XIV in France, in which the world was now shaped by the Treaty of Westphalia from 1648 that created the nation state. In effect, the whole understanding of politics had been already greatly changed by the time of Montesquieu's birth. And so from the time of his birth until the period in which he undertook his writing career, his story is primarily that of a French nobleman coming from the Bordeaux region in France, who was in his education trained to be a jurist and who assumed office relatively early on, but who also, within scarcely 30 years after his birth in 1687, had taken up his pen and realized that he was much more interested in writing about broad moral and philosophical questions. And when he struck it rich in writing the Persian Letters in 1723, which led to his introduction into the Académie Française, the French Academic Academy, from that point on, he did nothing but write. And so he wrote that critical work, which is distinguished by opening the question of the status of women, that's the Persian Letters, proceeded to discuss the fall of Rome in his book on the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, and then, of course, his great masterpiece by 1748, The Spirit of the Laws. So his whole career was a career that was a systematic and very disciplined development of a broad overview of human social and political development and what its philosophical grounds were. So when you ask who was Montesquieu, well, he was a nobleman trained to be a jurist who became a philosophical writer. That's the best summation one can give. And his contribution, of course, comes to us through the form of his philosophical writings. He was very much an enlightened man. He had all kinds of experiments in the physical sciences, things like freezing lambs' tongues in order to see how they responded to certain kinds of tests and other such things. So he had a breadth of interest, scientifically centered. He was extremely well read, both in ancient and modern writings. And of course, in his era, there were fairly widespread productions that we might call, loosely speaking, geographical, because it was the era of exploration and people traveling the earth, Dampierre and others writing about their travels in India and China and abroad and in the Americas. He read all of that and digested it all, and it all constitutes part of the material from which he then finally elaborates, in a sense, an account of the world. In fact, the best way to think about this is this. If you remember Voltaire, who of course was slightly older, slightly ahead of Montesquieu, but roughly contemporary with Montesquieu. Voltaire had a critic because he wasn't sure that Montesquieu had properly accounted for the universal spirit in world history. And so Voltaire himself wrote in the aftermath of Spirit of the Laws a book called Spirit, in which he, for hundreds of pages, tries to elaborate a meaning of spirit to distinguish it from what Montesquieu was doing. So that Montesquieu's work was so significant and so impressive in the middle of the 18th century that it forced people like Voltaire to come to terms with it as a challenge to be met in order to sustain the development of the Enlightenment theories that are reflected in works like the Encyclopédie that Diderot published, of course, with others and in association with Voltaire. So who was Montesquieu? Montesquieu was a thinker first and foremost. Bred in a home in La Brède, just south of Bordeaux, where his father was married to a woman who had Huguenot roots, which is important to remember that the mother came from a Protestant background. And given what had happened to the Huguenots in France, that's rather dramatic. And we can understand why Montesquieu took such strong positions in his writings against religious repression, because the Huguenots had experienced it. But he was nevertheless raised a Catholic, which of course his father was. So he had this fairly broad and comprehensive background that prepared him to look at the various strands of social, political, religious development and try to find an integrative approach to the account of them. That's who he was.
That's a great overview, and you know, certainly a fascinating background. You know, when it came for you personally, when it came to translating this work, you know, could you talk a little bit about your process and what that experience was like, taking his words, trying to, you know, stay truthful to the meaning, but also update the vernacular for today?
Well, that's a great question. I thank you for asking it, because people often ask me, what's it like doing a translation of a major work? And my answer is always very simple. I say, it's dog work. You've got to be as devoted as a dog to his master in order to effect a decent translation. And so the greatest task is simply submitting oneself to be taught by the person one is translating, not trying to interpret it, but trying to hear directly and understand what it is the author is saying. So I work very painstakingly. As I said at the outset, I work through the manuscripts such as they are, and they're not complete, and they are in several hands, his hand and secretary's hands, but I work through all of those, copying them all by hand myself, just to be sure I was reading correctly and getting complete command of it. And then I went through the work itself, comparing it with the manuscript as I went along, again, doing it all by hand. So this process began in the 1970s. So it's pre-digital. But the point of working directly by hand, reading manuscripts, trying to get exactly the orthography, and so that I know I understand the word that's being printed, that was the basis that I had to build upon. Now, after that, of course, I had to understand the language as it was used at the time. And there are differences, and it is really very tricky business, because if we try to translate 18th century French based on our study of 20th or 21st century French, we're going to make mistakes. I made those mistakes in ordinary conversation in France, where I would use words such as the French term enjouir, which has antecedents that produce the English enjoy, to ask people very intimate questions that I never should have been asking, because in the contemporary world, enjouir had come to mean having an orgasm. So you have to get through all of these things in order to say, what I'm translating is what he was saying and not what I'm saying or I'm hearing in a contemporary frame of reference. And then there's something else that's even more important than that. The reason I work so carefully through Montesquieu's French was that in my initial introduction to Montesquieu, like many readers, I believe, I was not enthralled, because I was introduced to an English translation that was really quite inadequate. And it seemed to lack any particular nuance, and it certainly lacked poetry. But when I was exposed to the French, I discovered his beautiful writing, that his literary abilities were extraordinary and superior. And it's hard to read him without becoming enthralled by him from the beginning of his work, the foreword, all the way through to the end. It's filled with poetic references. It's filled with nuances that one needs to be fairly literate in order to grasp, and grasping then to pursue to their natural consequences. So the translating work for me was essentially a work of transforming myself in light of what the author was doing. And once I had accomplished that, then I could come back to my own time and try to render what it is that I had experienced.
In its most basic overview, how would you describe the overarching themes of the Spirit of the Laws? There's so much in Spirit of the Laws. Each chapter breaks down, gets very granular. But how would you describe the sort of the overarching, not message, but overarching purpose of the text?
Yeah, I like that question a lot. That's a very good question. Thank you, because as you know, one of my chapters in the commentary is called The Order and Structure of the Spirit of the Laws. And it goes back to what Montesquieu says at the outset. He says, look, this is a work that, as you say, is very granular. It's filled with lots of differing things that might seem to be disconnected, but he warns the reader, it is all organized, it is all connected. And so he's saying to us, you've got to look for it. You've got to figure out what the connections are and pull it all together. I'll give you an illustration of this. So I'm not going to try to walk through the book with a sort of pedantic or academic presentation, but I'll give you an illustration. There's a book in which he writes a chapter called De l'administration des femmes, which is usually translated on the administration of women. But that translation actually misses something extremely important that he's conveying. For in the chapter that has that title, he's talking not only about the eligibility and capacity of women to rule the state, which he affirms, which is already important, even though it's 100 years after the Elizabethan era, it's important socially and politically. But he's also talking about the status of women in the household. And he makes the statement, women should be able to run the state, and women should not run the household. And your mind explodes, right, when you hear that. Wait a minute. How can they run the state and not run the household? Well, there's nuance here. And you only capture that nuance by translating that chapter not on the administration of women, but on the management of women. But for Montesquieu, it's very clear that what's going on is that what a society in general has to deal with the question of the status of women, not on the basis of a theory of subordination, but a theory of function. And so when he defends women against being made subjects or slaves, as they were presented in the Persian letters, which he does in book 16 of the Spirit of the Laws, he's saying in the household, they're not to be made slaves, even though they're not to be made in charge. But that has only to do with the fact that the natural basis of society is the family. And it has a certain structure and function that must be respected, because out of the family grows society itself. It is the pivot on which society develops. And if you undercut the pivot, you undercut society. But society, once developed itself, becomes the pivot for politics. And politics doesn't require the subjection of women. So you've got this really dualistic portrait coming from him. If you understand completely what he's saying based on the nuances, that will disappear if you don't translate accurately. And I can give you numerous examples of that kind of thing, which is taking place in the translation I presented.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Any other examples that, you know, you find particularly, in addition, illustrative?
Yes, there's one that's very important. For example, the ancient historian Herodotus maintain the argument very explicitly that religion can't actually transfer culture to culture. So religion is culturally specific. That was Herodotus's claim. Montesquieu, between book 14 and 18 of the Spirit of the Laws, takes that up subtly without directly addressing it, writing very carefully, almost esoterically, to refute Herodotus. And why is that important? Because once you establish that religion can transfer culturally and without resorting to conquest, you then create the foundation upon which you can expect to have an enlarged state rather than a small state. Because if cultures are confined and not transmissible, smallness is imperative. To have largeness possible, culture must be transmissible. This is the argument he's making. It's a very subtle argument. It's an argument that fends off all kinds of determinism, including environmental determinism, to prove what the fundamental human capacity is. That's what's being accomplished in the work. So that, like the question of women, these are just what you might call thematic emphases, which are developed incrementally across the body of the work. And just to give you a third quickly, his complete rejection of race-based slavery. He rejects all personal slavery, and in particular, race-based slavery. At a time when someone like Rousseau, which you will probably remember from the second discourse on the origins of inequality, is speculating about whether Africans are men or orangutans, Montesquieu simply dismisses that and makes the defense of the human claim, producing a solid abolitionist anti-slavery argument so powerful, so persuasive, that it is subsequently embraced by George III, King of England.
Yeah, some of the different ways, and especially his arguments against slavery are very fascinating, and it's certainly, I would love to talk about why certain threads that were picked up of his arguments later on by the founders, certain threads that were not picked up. It's interesting why something like that maybe wasn't picked up for the Constitution. I'm curious, not to jump too far ahead, but but definitely why certain threads were. Obviously, there's based in the U.S. politics of trying to compromise, but it is interesting to see which arguments they found salient and which ones they said, oh, it's not as relevant for our circumstances.
Well, that's a good question. And of course, they found more of them salient than the record really gives us a strong purchase on. And people like Gouverneur Morris and Alexander Hamilton found those arguments completely salient. They had no problem with that. They embraced the abolition principle. Or people like the governor of Rhode Island, Stephen Hopkins, he found it completely persuasive. Or people like Daniel Boal, who used Montesquieu to defend the liberty of the press. And they found those arguments completely persuasive. But in the context of the debate on the Constitution, what was important was the constitutional question, i.e., there were people who were looking at the question of the structure of government more than they were looking at the question of the foundations of society. And you can see this not just in the American founding, but broadly speaking, take Edmund Burke in England, who, of course, defended the American cause. People often forget, because they talk about Burke as kind of the father of modern conservatism, because they misunderstand Burke and conservatism. But they forget that Burke's earliest work, written not long after the emergence of the Spirit of the Laws and its influence, was the Vindication of the Rights of Natural Society. Now, this concept of natural society, that's a Montesquieu concept, which is running counter to the concept of individual, separated, atomistic human beings that you find in Locke and Hobbes. And the natural society is founded in the family, so that the people who saw that and embraced that argument were actually following Montesquieu. And you might be surprised, but because this is not something widely known, but our scholarship in recent decades has demonstrated that the most frequently cited authority through the founding era, not at the convention, but through the founding era, the most frequently cited authority after the Bible was Montesquieu.
That's very interesting, especially just to the extent, considering that Montesquieu is barely given any mention at all. In, you know, I don't remember encountering Montesquieu once in high school. One of the questions that Montesquieu first begins with is his understanding of virtue. It's pretty clear from that Montesquieu, especially at the beginning, he's starting with ancient philosophy, like Aristotle. So how does Montesquieu think about virtue compared to how, someone like Aristotle thought of virtue?
Yeah, that's a great question too. How does he reconcile virtue in the modern context with virtues that was understood in the ancient world? And that's really the reason people often don't talk about Montesquieu, because they think he didn't reconcile it. They think he rejected Aristotelian virtue, and therefore he was just another Hobbesian who didn't admit it. And they don't take seriously his criticism of Hobbes that he writes in the first book of The Spirit of the Laws. And they don't take seriously what I point out, which is the complete absence of any reference to John Locke in The Spirit of the Laws, though Montesquieu was entirely familiar with Locke. So we get to the question of virtue in Montesquieu by seeing that his account of ancient virtue situates it in the confined politics of the polis, which is inadequate for any purposes of human perpetuation, preservation, i.e. these small city-states are always going to be at war, either with one another or with larger despotic powers, and they're not going to survive. So the problem is not the failure of virtue, but the failure of the political form that was required to sustain virtue as it was understood in the ancient world. That's why he specifically distinguishes between what we can call moral virtue and political virtue. So for political purposes, virtue required the love of equality, the commitment, the self-denying commitment to the polis itself, to the political institutions. But that also incorporated what, of course, Aristotle identified as excellence, or the habit of choosing the excellent thing, the virtuous thing, performance, excellence of performance, let's put it that way. Well, Montesquieu understands that, but he understands it with a modification that's extremely important to us, which ties to Aristotle. Because in the first book of Aristotle's Politics, we're introduced to what is called a defense of natural slavery. Now, everybody who reads the Politics carefully knows that when Aristotle defines natural slavery, he's doing so in order to reject conventional slavery. And he knows that most slavery is conventional, i.e. people are conquered in war and made slaves, not because they are by nature slaves. So the natural slavery argument actually is an anti-slavery argument, but it is inexplicit. It is too subtle. So how does Montesquieu change it? In Book 11 of The Spirit of the Laws, he has a single statement which becomes the predicate upon which he builds Book 15 in the attack on slavery. And he says, every human being thought to have a free soul ought to be self-governing. That one little expression, that is so rich and so powerful, because here's what it means. Self-government is nothing other than the Aristotelian principle of moderation. Virtue, the most commonly accessible virtue for human beings. That's self-government. That's what he's talking about there. He isn't talking about political institutions. He's talking about the capacity for virtue. So in that statement, he affirms the capacity for virtue. He says it is distinctive and characteristic of being human. And it is on that basis that in Book 15, he rejects slavery. Because recognizing those who are enslaved as humans means they should be self-governing, not enslaved. So we see he actually does develop the Aristotelian argument, but now he's doing it in a modern context. And I'm going on too long, but let me say one more thing about this. It's really important that he can make this affirmation of the human, because he does not fall into the trap of those who ask the question whether Africans are human beings or orangutans. Now, to ask that question is really very bizarre from Montesquieu's perspective, because Montesquieu's aware that nobody ever asks the question, is an orangutan a human? They only ask, is a human an orangutan? Nobody ever enslaved an orangutan or had sex with an orangutan. So Montesquieu recognizes the question that early modern science was asking as disingenuous, as ducking the moral question. Namely, we have obligations of humanity to human beings. And by posing the question as a scientific question, we released ourselves from our moral considerations. And Montesquieu is fighting that off. That's what's going on in the book.
As the title suggests, you know, a lot of this book deals with laws and what laws are. But, you know, what are laws according to Montesquieu? Obviously, a very general question, but feel free to take that in whichever direction you'd like.
Well, I'm going to ask you to bear with me, because what I say to people is, look, the very first word is the most important word in the whole book. And that's the word spirit. So it's the spirit of the laws. The focus is on the spirit. And so what does spirit mean? Well, my first chapter in the commentary explains that. It says, look, the word esprit, which we translate spirit, doesn't mean something ethereal. It means mind, reason, intelligence. And so the book is about the intelligence, the reason, the mind behind the laws. What are the human intentions and purposes? So from that perspective, the laws are all those rules we give ourselves. But the heart of the matter is, why? Why do we give ourselves those rules? What's the mind behind them? And so he's showing how that mind is elaborated in any given society and across time. And particular with reference to the fact that politics has to be understood not as a pursuit of power, but the limitation of power. And that's a fundamentally different orientation. And he gets there by giving us an anthropology, which says first you get the family, then you get society. And when societies come to be, which basically start with the extended family, as you know, and so it becomes numerous enough that it's no longer the nuclear family and it's a society, that people then realize from this accumulation of resources in a single community, there's a certain kind of power. And hence, they seek to turn that power to their own advantage, i.e. they begin to pursue power. So the pursuit of power is not politics. The pursuit of power is the exploitation of the resources of society. Politics emerges to put a limit on the pursuit of the exploitation of resources. That's why politics is to confine power, not to pursue power. That's what the spirit of the law is about. That's the mind behind the laws. Laws, which are generated by politics, are a constant attempt to confine power.
So I think you've sort of given it away a bit, but you know, what type of government would you then say Montesquieu is advocating for? Is he advocating for, you know, a limited government, you know, similar to Locke, or, you know, is it something slightly more subtle?
It is similar to Locke. It is a limited government. It's the government I call it of libertarian individualism, frankly, meaning not that you get rid of the family, you keep the family, because the family is what spawns the individualism. Infants can't be individuals, as you know, they must be raised up to that. So it's libertarian individualism. That's the basis, that's the foundation that you want to sustain, according to Montesquieu. And that means then that you look at society not as a thing to be changed, but a thing to be protected. And if there's any difference between the contemporary perspective that we have today and what Montesquieu is conveying in his work, the difference lies here. Whereas today, the contemporary perspectives that prevail seem to make the argument you need to change society in order to improve the fortunes of human beings. Montesquieu's perspective was, you don't need to change society, you need to confine politics to improve, or to use George Washington's favorite word, ameliorate the conditions of human beings. It is confining the pursuit of power that gives the greatest opportunity for human prosperity.
And, you know, obviously, friend of mine at that time, especially, it was, you know, debates over religion and practice of, you know, the ability to for different sects of religion to practice. You mentioned a little bit Montesquieu's own background. related to his mixed Christian background. But what were some of Montesquieu's other thinking framings and thinkings around religion? What did he see as the role, or at least the way in which people should be allowed to practice religion?
Good, wonderful question, because he has a couple of things to say there. Of course, starting in book 12 and going all the way up through book 24, he says this: in the first place, religion is not a civil or secular dimension of our life, and therefore it cannot, its doctrines, precepts cannot be enforced through law. It must only be enforced through religious precept. So he makes a rigid distinction. We call it separation of church and state, but it's already there in Montesquieu. Secondly, he says that there are several forms of religion. Those that can only establish themselves by conquest are false religions from his perspective. And he certainly describes Islam as a religion which is able to be transmitted from one culture to the other only by means of conquest. And he considers that illegitimate. Christianity, on the other hand, he thought proved the principle that he was defending against Herodotus, that religion transmits across cultures, not by conquest, but through intercourse, or to use the broader term, and here we get into the interesting part of the argument, commerce. So when he's defending commerce as the basis of modern liberalism, he's not just talking about trade in goods and services. He's talking about trade in ideas, and especially religious ideas. And he says on that foundation, people can develop religious, expressive religion in liberty, with freedom, because there are no such thing as thought crimes, according to Montesquieu. And it is on this foundation that he makes the reiterated statement that Christianity is the greatest gift that humankind has ever received. What he's focused on there is not so much the teaching of Christ, though that's fundamental in Christianity, presumably we know because of what he talks about Julian the Apostate. That's another question. We can come back to that if you want to get into the weeds. But what he means by that is that Christianity is partner to this idea of the transmissibility of religion across cultures. And it can be sustained independently of political command. And that's the formula he was looking for. So his attitude toward religion is it needs to be sustained in human communities without resort to command, without the application of power.
For him, at least, was, and this might be going a bit far afield of the spirit of laws, but what role did religion play in his own life? Was it something significant, or was it more like this this kind of intellectual exercise that he found interesting to try and figure out the role of religion or something, was he personally a believer?
Well, he died a confessional Catholic. I'll put it that way. There was doubt about his religious convictions, frankly, because of some of his writings. The spirit of the laws was briefly identified and targeted by the Index. He fought that off, publishing his Défense de l'Esprit de Law, which is itself a full book. I couldn't include that in this work. It'd been much too long then. But he was attacked by Jansenists and some others, who were, of course, the devout Catholics and the dogmatists. So that there were people who doubted his religious conviction. In spite of that, he brought in his final hours, a priest. He made his confession and died a confessional Catholic. And he makes, of course, as I said, in the spirit of the laws itself, the statement that Christianity was the greatest gift that humankind had ever received. So I think we have to take him at his word with respect to that he did not disparage religion, though he certainly was capable of criticizing religion in general because of the differences in religions. And when he talks about the atrocious Japanese, that partly has to do with the character of their religion. When he talks about Confucianism, he's talking about the character of what is religion-like. He doesn't think it's really a religion, but religion-like among the Chinese. Or when he talks about superstition, as he does when he refers to savage tribes in Louisiana and other such things. all of these are ways of giving what we would like to think of as a comparative understanding of religion. But his comparative understanding of religion is not dismissive of the possibility of true religion.
In addition to the influence of Christianity on his life, what were the other primary influences, either different, strains of thought, or who were the other, individual thinkers that Montesquieu read and was inspired by?
Well, of course, he read almost everything. It's incredible. If you could visit his library, as I have done at Libret, which is this magnificent structure, this very high vaulted ceilings with this rich wood paneling throughout. I would have died to have spent my life there. If I could have only arranged that somehow, I would have loved it. But he had everything. But he himself says in his Pensées, if you want to understand what I have done, you need to see it in light of Plato and Aristotle. So he thinks he is engaged in an ongoing dialogue with Plato and Aristotle. You will find that those are the most frequently cited authors over the course of the work among the philosophical authors. And his arguments are more specifically responsive to their arguments than to the arguments of anyone else. And I always take it as a rule of thumb that the argument you respond to is the argument you're most influenced by.
Yeah, I think that's broadly true. Certainly, what people are moved by emotionally, positive or negative or otherwise, certainly
yes,
tends to be the thing that is weighing on their thoughts. Montesquieu, I think part of the interesting story with Montesquieu, at least for me, and what made me interested in this translation and commentary, is just the kind of the contemporary perception of Montesquieu. So I was wondering, how do contemporary scholars tend to interpret meaning and relevance of Montesquieu's work, and what do you see them getting broadly right, and what are they getting wrong? And obviously, you don't have to name any names, but no. feel free to throw some stones and arrows.
No, I appreciate that. I think I've already indicated, I think, that the work of going back several decades now of Thomas Pangle, identifying Montesquieu as an apostle of modern liberalism, is spot on. And I think that most of the commentary since then, and it has really burgeoned since the 1970s, that's the period in which Pangle wrote, in which I began my work on it. And we've just seen a real explosion of commentaries on Montesquieu, mainly in articles, a few books here and there, both in the United States and in Europe. And the main focus of all of them is trying to tease out the question of Montesquieu's prescriptivism. Is Montesquieu prescribing monarchy, prescribing democracy, just prescribing despotism, et cetera, et cetera? There is a teasing out of angles of view that are fairly tortured by this point, I must say. And there are many criticisms I've read, and many of them I have great appreciation for, people across the board, but they are isolating their thinking about Montesquieu by trying to pigeonhole him. And if anything, what I'm doing in this commentary is broadening the view to say, look, yes, he does prescribe something, but it has nothing to do with the classical forms of analysis. It has to do with this concept of an extended regime. Let's not use the terms republic, monarchy, etc., because he told us early on in Spirit of the Laws that England is a republic disguised as a monarchy, which means he conveys that these constitutional debates are confusing. So let's not talk about that. Let's just ask, what, for practical purposes, is he suggesting? And he makes this clear to us when he talks about who are the real founders. And what you will discover in that chapter on the founders, or legislators, to use his term, is that he doesn't mention certain people you expect. He mentions primarily philosophical thinkers. So he doesn't go, as Machiavelli did, to the unarmed prophets of the Moseses, those who come freighted with a great deal of religious authority. He mentions the philosophers. he's talking about Plato and Aristotle, and then the contemporaries like Harrington, whose attempts he disparages, or Thomas More, etc. So why are these the legislators? Well, it seems it's because these are the people who have raised the question we discussed earlier, whether the hope of amelioration for humankind lies in changing the conditions of society or in changing the conditions of politics. And he sees an antithesis there, where others have tended to unite those things into a single conception. The commentaries have, in approaching Montesquieu, still been subject to looking to this united idea or conception where the change in society is being sought. And that is not what Montesquieu is seeking. So I would say what we can get out of the commentaries, which are rich, is the opportunity to go back and re-examine Montesquieu from the point of view of what would we think if Montesquieu were to tell us there is no such thing as a utopia. There is no reformation of the human soul that creates a utopian existence. That human beings are exactly what we see. And our challenge is to make our institutional efforts and our efforts of explanation match what we see, not change what we see.
It's certainly a way of thinking that is it very fascinating, in part because of the impact that he would have on a lot of idealistic political thinkers later. I'm wondering, in addition to that, talking then about this contemporary thing, but also contemporary influence, but also just, the impact that Spirit of Laws has just had on thinkers and political actors and constitutions and, political, pragmatists and idealists. What has really been the impact of Spirit of Laws on the world today? Where do we see, when we look at today at the world, where do we see the impact of it?
Oh, that's a great, great question. And I think it's very straightforward and direct. I mentioned earlier the Treaty of Westphalia, which created the nation state. The nation state reformulated human existence, not socially, but politically, in the sense that no people can actually establish themselves without establishing themselves in the form of a nation state. That's how they can interact with the rest of the world. Now, that's not been the case from the beginning. That's been the case since 1648. Montesquieu's theory is the only theory that operationalized the nation state. That's the way to think about it. That's what his philosophy has done. It came in 100 years later, after the nation state, to give it a solid philosophical foundation, operational foundation. So the principles of constitutionalism and lawmaking in a constitutional setting, those are the principles necessary to sustain the conception of the nation state. And they were developed most by Montesquieu. And there are lots of writers who wrote on constitutional principles. Blackstone, I could mention immediately, 1776 in England. Or we could talk about Maitland's survey of British constitutionalism that gives us a broader view of that question. And of course, we have the whole tradition of natural law theories and constitutional making from Grotius and Pufendorf right on into our time. But the only one who gave a sustained discussion of constitutional arrangements, not in the context of a mixed regime, but in the context of functionality, was Montesquieu. And that's the basis for the discussion of the nation state prevailing throughout the earth to this day.
My final question, obviously we, there's so much that we weren't able to get to today, but there really is, this could take up we could probably talk for 50 hours about each chapter, and I'm sure it would not be exhaustive at all. But why should people read Spirit of the Laws today? Or at least, if they want to read it, what sections would you really recommend they read? As I mentioned before, in my political theory survey in college, we read Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau. There was mention of Montesquieu, but we read no Montesquieu. Was this a mistake?
Yes, absolutely. And I will tell you why. Because the question of what you should read is this: start at the beginning. Start at the beginning. Don't expect you're going to read it through. It's not bedtime reading unless you have trouble falling asleep. So start at the beginning and take it little by little. It's written incrementally in short chapters primarily. So you don't have to read it all at once. That's a great thing to think about. And then remember this. Once you start, if you start in that spirit, you'll have a lot of trouble stopping. You'll keep coming back to it and advancing the argument. That's what George III discovered. I mentioned George III being influenced by it, but I don't think I put it in context for you. When he was still Prince of Wales, had not yet ascended to the throne, he was reading Montesquieu, reading it so closely that he was in fact translating it. You might say paraphrasing, but he was translating. So that mine is actually the fourth, not the third translation, because George's, though unpublished, was written already in the 1750s, just a couple of years after the work appeared. And it's obvious as he's going through this, almost word by word, and certainly chapter by chapter, he's reacting at each stage of the process to what he's reading, taking each section on its own terms. And so I say, that's how you read it the way George III read it. Start at the beginning, go through very slowly. Don't think you have to rush and complete it, and just let it carry you.
I think that's that's wonderful advice. And I think that advice could apply to many texts too. These political treatises are definitely not meant to be read in one sitting. They're certainly meant to be read slowly, chewed over, argued with, built up, torn apart, everything in between.
Yes.
So I'm wondering, with this project done, are you sick of Montesquieu, or are you still jumping back in and reading more? How do you feel about Spirit of Laws now?
Well, that's a really good way for us to close this discussion, because I'm in my 80th year. And I actually had conceived that this project, which lasted several decades before I finished it, and I've written many things in between, of course, was going to be the last thing that I had really done, apart from an occasional pieces. I mean, last week I hacked off an op-ed in Spanish for La Tercera in Chile, but that doesn't count. So I thought I was done. but I mentioned George III. And his several hundred page rendition of the Spirit of the Laws. And so I've decided that if I have the time, certainly that which has only just been opened up by the Royal Archives, we didn't know it existed before, needs to see the light of day. And so I suspect I shall be, over the course of the next year, trying to work up a publication of George III's version of Montesquieu with appropriate commentary.
Well, when you get to that, we'll certainly have you on again, and we'll dig deeper into Spirit of the Laws. William, thank you so much for being a guest on the New Books Network.
Very welcome, Caleb. It was a delight to join you.